May I speak to you in the name of the one true, holy, and living God. It is so good to be back among you. As many of you know, I have been out in the world running the first official few sessions of my teaching ministry, The Contemplative Gaze, this past few weeks. It's good to be home again. I feel so blessed to be part of the Ascension community and to know that I am tethered by you. One of the things I'm discovering as I go to different churches is that it can be disorienting to move around so much. Thankfully, when I first dreamed up this ministry, the Holy Spirit reminded me that I would need a spiritual home as an abiding place from which to go and return. So thank you for being my anchor. Knowing you are here makes a huge difference in my own ability to stay grounded because I know I will find rest when I return with you. You are helping make this broader ministry possible, and I hope that you understand that your welcome of me is your gift to the larger church. By offering me a safe home, you are making something possible that would not otherwise be possible. Your offering is one of the many forms of stewardship that this congregation engages in, and I am incredibly grateful that you have chosen to take it on. Stewardship is not only about keeping the lights on, the building heated, and the programs funded. It is so much more than that. Stewardship is the tangible expression of our recognition that we find love in community, in seeing one another and every aspect of creation as inherently valuable. Those whose lives you are touching by offering this may not ever know that it is you who have done it, but the joy they experience in discovering and appreciating the art that they have in their sanctuaries is a tangible expression of gratitude which I can now reflect back to you. The wonder on their faces, their delight in the nuances they had never noticed before, these are gifts you are giving to the church and to the world. This work renews the appreciation of the beauty and bounty of our sanctuaries. And it also renews our wonder in the creativity and vision of the one who created all that is. While we may all be unsure what church will look like 50 to 100 years from now, I promise you, providing an anchor for those of us who are exploring non-traditional types of ministry is a vital aspect of the Church of the Future's formation. So from the bottom of my heart, I thank you all. I will be holding a retreat day on December 8th, which is the second Sunday of Advent here at Ascension, and we will use this same contemplative process to look at some of the art that we have here in this space. I hope many of you will join me. There are also two other ministries which your stewardship is helping make possible by providing me a home here at Ascension. The first is my work with the Diocesan Ecumenical and Interfaith Commission. From November 5th through 7th, I'm going to Toronto as a representative of the Diocese of New York to the Parliament of World Religions. I promise I'll report back on that when I return. Though, depending on how the midterms go, you know. We need a toehold in Canada. The second is my work with the Diocesan Anti-Human Trafficking Task Force. Last week, I spent the better part of 3 afternoons volunteering at their installation just north of Union Square, The Gift Box. I heard that Mother Liz took a contingent of you to visit the gift box last Sunday, and that's really good. Thanks to Mother Liz also, we will be having a liturgy, hosting a liturgy on January 10th, which is a Thursday, as part of the annual Human Trafficking Awareness Days. So we'll keep you updated on that as it comes together, but please mark your calendars. I'm new to this particular work, so I, like you, am learning and absorbing as much as I can about it. I know from posts on Facebook recently that some of you in this congregation read the article this past week in the New York Times titled "The Case of Jane Doe Ponytail." It's the story of a woman who was trafficked and who ended up dying by suicide right here in New York City in Queens. It's a hard read, but it's eye-opening. If you want to go even deeper into this world with learning, I highly recommend Rachel Lloyd's book, Girls Like Us. Lloyd writes from the perspective of someone who was trafficked herself. She later founded the nonprofit GEMS, Girls Education and Mentoring Service, which helps girls and women escape trafficking. Human trafficking, not only for sex but also for labor, is one of the fastest growing and most lucrative crimes in the world today, second only to illegal drugs and tied with arms dealing. We can talk about it in more detail whenever you like, but I want to take this moment to dismantle two of the main myths about trafficking. Number one, that the people who are trafficked choose this as a lifestyle. And number two, that it's easy to break out of being trafficked, so why don't they just run away? Okay, so myth number one. There is no other way to say this except forcefully. No one chooses to be trafficked. No one. But our culture invests a lot of time and money into making us think that they do. We are all indoctrinated into the myth through a myriad of sources: music lyrics, films, television shows that glorify prostitution, fashion photography, advertising, and perhaps most sadly, a criminal justice system that focuses more on vilifying the victims than on the purchasers of the product. One of the most sobering insights Rachel Lloyd discusses in her book is that some police officers refer to the nighttime runs to arrest prostitutes as the trash run. They are not referring to the customers as trash, they are referring to the victims as trash. The girls and boys, women and men, who are trafficked are seen as trash by our society, not as human beings. And myth number two, it's not as easy to break out of the life once you have been trafficked. Many of the people who are trafficked are brought into the life at very young ages, often because they are vulnerable due to systemic injustice and/or family situations that prevent them from growing up with adults who are able to take care of them. Their handler, and that's the nice word for it, is the first person in their lives who has shown them a consistent semblance of kindness and love. The hook that they are offered can sometimes be something that seems as insignificant to us as a meal at McDonald's and some attentive listening. Sometimes that's all it takes to buy a child's loyalty and heart. This is true, by the way, across every socioeconomic demographic. Kids living in poverty are not the only ones who are trafficked. When the relationship with the trafficker begins, the victim is totally unaware that that is the end result for which they are being groomed. They truly think that the handler loves them and is their boyfriend or sweetheart. And they continue to think this. So it's understandable that they have a hard time breaking free. Stockholm syndrome is the technical psychological term for this, but another way to express it is coercive control. How many of us have been caught at one point in our lifetimes in a relationship where we kept thinking, if only I do whatever, things will get better. It'll be okay. I bet every one of us has. Which leads me to our gospel text today. I'm sure you thought I was never going to get there. This text speaks to exactly that kind of coercive control of one human over another. And the text recognizes that coercion happens systemically as well, writ large in the public sphere. The Roman imperial government was all about coercive control. And yes, I know they were geniuses of engineering and traveling and making roads and government and keeping things in order. But the Pax Romana was founded on the power of a repressive state. We may enjoy the film Gladiator as entertainment, but for the people of that time, gladiatorial contests were a very public way in which the power of the empire was displayed, meted out, and hierarchies and punishment were enforced. Attending a gladiatorial contest was often not optional. Caesar Augustus required the attendance of those who were ruled by him. He also came up with the whole system of who would sit where in order to create a visible bodily arrangement that told every person there where they stood in the pecking order. So Mark tells us that James and John were asking Jesus where they were in the pecking order. Basically, they were saying, dude, when you are king, we want to sit next to the throne. That's a direct reference to the seating in the Roman arenas. James and John were stuck in a paradigm of how things should be, and they didn't want to shake it. The passage then illustrates how the desire for particular personal power also occurs as coercive government. You know, Mark tells us, that among the Gentiles, those whom they recognize as their rulers lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. So how did it work? By offering benefits as enticement. In Roman times, they called it bread and circus. In modern times, McDonald's and attentive listening, or judicial appointments and campaign rallies. Never forget that punitive consequences are prominently displayed, ever ready at the case in case of disobedience to the status quo. Mass incarceration, children in cages, sexual assault survivors being shamed, reporters murdered with impunity. So what is the remedy that Jesus speaks of? I like to think of it as original grace. Because what else is the story of God that becomes human except the ultimate tactile embodied expression of the sanctity of our inherent worth? God chose to become one of us because God says that creation is good, not depraved. Jesus assures us that God recognizes the worth and dignity of every person, that we are made in God's image. Systemic and personal coercion is not how God would choose for us to join in co-creating order out of chaos. The God who chose to share our condition was killed, just like Jane Doe Ponytail in Queens. This Jesus knows what it means to be seen as trash. This Jesus knows the depths of despair of those who are pushed to the margins. And this Jesus affirms that every human, every being, is created and loved by God. So that is the grace to which we can return. It's not a grace that is earned by works, by measuring up, by squashing others down to get ahead. This is a grace of connection and mutuality, a grace of knowing that one is beloved. This original grace comes to us at birth and never leaves us. It is not the grace of a coercive, punitive God meted out by the thimbleful. Instead, it is the grace God granted to each of us, the grace that says we are going to sit at both God's right and God's left hand. Those are the places that God grants to every one of us, because we are beloved and we are all the ones for which they have been prepared. Amidst the many stories I heard about trafficking this past week, one stood out. It was the story of the four words that a neighbor used to make a connection with a young woman she suspected was being trafficked. Now, those four words were not an instant cure. It still took time for the young woman to get away from her handler. But they established that initial connection and trust. They opened the door. So those four words were not, "Let me help you." They were not, "Here's the police hotline." They were not, "You should run away." Here's what they were. "It's not your fault." It's not your fault. Those four words were a sign to the young woman that her neighbor did not see her as trash. Instead, the neighbor saw her as a human being first, a person with dignity and worth and beloved by God. Those four words establish connection and mutuality. They are about hearing the expression, "The first shall be last, and the last shall be first," differently than we often hear it. Too often, it is egregiously used as yet another way to shame and blame us and further divide us from each other in a hierarchy of our sinfulness and depravity, an accounting of good and bad deeds. But what if instead, we hear it as the description of an infinity loop? Sometimes I am down and you hold me up, and sometimes you are down and I hold you up. Because we both know that there is good and bad in all of us, and we both know that God is with us and in the space between us, and we both know that we are beloved. God created me and you and Jane Doe Ponytail, and God knows that we are not trash. And God knows that whatever horrific thing happens to us, it's not our fault. Amen.